The four great catalysts of being. We're going to talk about equanimity, love, compassion, and joy, in that order. And these are originally called the Brahma Viharas, meaning, this is pre-Buddhist, meaning that if you can cultivate these four whatevers, you too can be given entrance to the palace of the gods. So they're very good qualities to strengthen in our lives. And the Buddhists, they like to appropriate things from the Hindus, without attribution, of course, and just like the Christians did with the pagans, and they're called the four limitless ones, but they're given a very different feature. But I want to give you a little bibliography first. I take it that we're going to be mostly working with this book by Pema for the next few weeks. Is that pretty much the text?
That's sort of a source.
A source. Okay. Well, here are the sources for this source. Michael's favorite guy, Wang Chen. But this was, I think this is still in print. Herbert Gunter writes like a German. And every once in a while, he has this brilliant way of putting things. And he's the one who came up with the four catalysts of being, which we're going to talk about. And it's a way to actually look at how they interact with each other. You can also look at a new translation. And this is only one chapter, by the way. This is not the entire book. Not the entire book, just one chapter. This came out, Rest, Finding Rest in the Nature of the Mind, by Wang Chenpa. This came out last year. And if you really want the guts of things, there's a extended chapter in Words of My Perfect Teacher that Pato Rinpoche is attempting to break your heart. So if you want your heart broken, this is a very good source. And I have a handout for you too. But so, I was thinking, you know, it looks like we're all Westerners here. And because we're Westerners, we've sort of been trained to think in certain ways about our emotions. And we sort of have heard of, like, the golden mean, that you're supposed to, like, you know, if you not get too far in one direction, you can pull yourself toward the middle. You know, for instance, in discussion of courage, courage is a virtue, but it's between being foolhardy, reckless on one side and timid on the other. So you're supposed to make sure you don't go into any extremes. You sort of find the middle place based upon situations, based upon whatever. And that's not this. We're not trying to moderate anything. When we talk about love, we mean complete. We talk about compassion, we mean boundless. We talk about joy, we mean without reference to anything in particular. We talk about equanimity, the most difficult of the four. We're talking about something beyond the nature of our concepts, conceptual minds. So these attitudes allow us not only to live a better life and a happier life, they also allow others around us to be happier. They also pull us toward reality, aka enlightenment, in terms of being a Buddhist. So these features will accompany one on the entire Buddhist path. You don't graduate from them, and you don't really perfect them. They're boundless, meaning we can always do more. We can always fall back and recover. I do like your shirt. So So they are equanimity, love, or loving kindness, but I like love a little better. Compassion and joy, their contemplations, their attitudes, but I was thinking that it's not like a passive, I have this attitude of so-and-so. It's like having attitude. It's like active. It's got some spiciness to it. It's got some bravado. Yes, love can have bravado. Actually, love has a tremendous amount of bravado when we don't do it the wrong way. Otherwise, we can be a little cowardly and kind of stuck. But why are these boundless? They're also boundless because they take us beyond our limited concepts of things. And they sort of stretch us out into a wider world, also into a greater understanding of who and what we all are. So their attitudes are also kind of ways of relating to anybody. Now, there are four. What do you think is the most difficult? Love, equanimity, compassion, or joy?
Yes.
What's that?
Yes.
No. I think three of the four are actually pretty natural. There's one that's really unnatural.
You already told us it was equanimity.
It's equanimity. Someone was listening. No. Equanimity is the most difficult. And the sources say you start with that one. Because it's much easier without equanimity, think about it, to screw up love, joy, and compassion. So equanimity is where you start. What do we mean by equanimity? Well, we all have our preferences. I like some people more than others. I really do. I have a certain taste in music and cars and clothes, and there's some things that, you know, irritate the hell out of me. I don't think that makes me particularly unique in this room. So what we're talking about when we talk about equanimity is beginning to smooth out those edges a little bit. So we're not so quick on our soapbox. We're a little less judgmental. We're a little less wholly positive, wholly negative. We see better the nuance, the holes in some of our concepts of preference or non-preference. I mean, we're all embodied, so we have habits of approach and avoidance. We can't have it any other way. Go order a meal at a restaurant. And you're playing, what are you doing? You're playing around with your preferences. And there's some stuff that you will not order ever. There's no problem with that. But equanimity is to be able to see that a little more objectively. You know, maybe that's on the menu and somebody else likes that. But usually the contemplation involved, or the thinking involved, or what brings us to equanimity, is contemplating friends and non-friends. People we like and people we don't like. And in Buddhism, it's really easy to say, okay, everybody in a previous lifetime has been your mother. And you can do all kinds of interesting things looking at the fact that, you know, somebody who's your soulmate this lifetime may have been a mortal enemy once upon a time. Although to me that sounds a little abstract. And for us Westerners, maybe a little hard to kind of get into. However, We also have no people in our lives who maybe made a terrible impression on us when we first met them. Maybe they were like too critical or too much of a know-it-all or too lazy or something we judged them poorly on. And they sort of wore on us better. And now they're kind of friends. What used to be judgmental is actually appreciating their sort of sharpness. Or what seemed to be lazy actually is more spacious, and it's very comforting to be around them. So we know, a lot of us know of people who we didn't really like when we first met. Or we, on the other hand, liked a lot when we first met. And now, not so much. Often folks we dated or became partners with. Now, maybe not so much. Remember how much we fell in love and they couldn't do anything wrong, and now they can't do anything right. Some of us that have had a couple marriages know that score pretty well. So when we get all hooked in terms of being really, really positive, sort of Pollyannish about someone, or really negative and disparaging, we smooth that out a little bit. We don't invite toxic people into our lives. That's not necessary. Nor should we idealize people who we admire. People we admire have faults. People who we dislike have positive features. So we work on smoothing that out. And that's the beginning training of equanimity. In some ways, it's the most important of the four because it's the way in. Without an attitude of equanimity, it's going to be hard to not screw up the other ones. Let me stop, see how we're doing. Questions, thoughts?
We've been following Pema Chodron, you know, as a source, and she puts the equanimity last, and mm-hmm. I've got loving kindness next week, so I'm wondering if someone else can go first. Anyway,
Roberta, you can present loving kindness with the attitude of having first cultivated equanimity, and by the time we get to equanimity, people get really good at it.
Okay.
Yeah. Besides which, as we'll talk about in a moment, loving kindness is one way to remedy the difficulties of equanimity. We'll get there. What you look like you're saying? You're about to.
What's that?
You're about to say something.
No.
Okay. So you can all go out and do that, right? Like today, even when somebody is a little slow getting out after the light turns green. Good. Then, what's the problem with equanimity? What if you do it in the wrong way? We'll talk about what the wrong way means in a minute.
I mean, part of the wrong way is when you say to yourself, that doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. And really, inside, you're like, this is so irritating. But I'm not going to let it bother me. And so it's like mm-hmm. not, you're mouthing the everything's okay. You're churning the I hate this. This is so irritating. When is it going to end?
And then you throw somebody something at somebody.
Or the equivalent.
But isn't that's still dualistic, right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. as long as I am stuck in the dualistic mode, so an alternative for me is to try to be curious mm-hmm. and have a beginner's mind, or just the aspect of judgment can be so subtle, but
yes.
I can try to be open. And I used a word that that was really appropriate. But to be open mm-hmm. and to notice it, whether it's in traffic or mm-hmm. wherever, the willingness is always there. I do get stuck. I do, throw a tizzy.
I have this ongoing conversation with my wife when she's driving and I'm in the passenger seat, and she's like, stuck behind somebody who says, "Gas pedal, buddy, gas pedal, it's over there." I say, "Okay, listen." It's okay. They're probably on the phone. She says, "Don't try to make excuses for them."
"They're probably on the phone" means you ought to be careful with them.
Right.
But those are wonderful learning opportunities. I mean, that's a complete 180 for me, right? It's just to see things, where's the silver lining in this mm-hmm. moment of frustration? Mm-hmm. Catch myself and then back off from that.
And we have to appreciate how instinctual that frustration is.
Absolutely.
There's something in our physiology that doesn't like our momentum stopped. There's also a lot in our physiology that approaches certain people and situations and avoids others. The problem with equanimity is we become indifferent. We can become a little too cool and relaxed. Or I remember in the 1970s when I first started becoming a Sangha member, people were a little laid back, and that irritated me. It's like, why are people so talking so soft and gently? It's like, and I'm like up a tree eating bananas. So what happens is, when we take one of these conditions, we make them into an identity, into a character for ourselves. I have equanimity. We put ourselves in a box. We become not only different, we become sort of laid back. We begin to lose interest. And that's a problem that is the downfall of this particular quality. And it needs a remedy. And I have a handout for everybody. Even though I love giving out handouts. It's one of my favorite things. I should have more equanimity to it. I made 12. I think this. I sent Elise a PDF, so it'll be on the website. And this is from Gunter. I'm sorry?
I memorized the PDF.
Ooh, then you.
No, I don't know. I don't have to have one.
Okay. Herbert Gunter is not a graphic designer, so this is not a great kind of thing, but it does give us the basic information on the interactions between the four. And we're close. Yeah, Roberta, we can look down together.
Here will be your shoulder.
Okay, we'll look down together. Okay. You see, so at the top says equanimity. The bottom, the arrow, the dotted arrow may turn into. That's a negative quality. Okay? The remedy, I don't know why he has the arrows pointing the other way, but he does. The quality to remedy apathy or being laid back is love. So if equanimity turns into being indifferent or laid back or too cool for comfort, then the intervention would be to work on the quality of love instead of tormenting yourself because you don't have enough equanimity or because you have too much, which is what we Westerners tend to do. Because we don't like being immoderate. So, now he says love here. Sometimes I see loving kindness. I like love. Because love is a stirring kind of word. Loving kindness has a little it feels a little bit lukewarm to me. You know, when I talk about love, we're talking about some quality of passion, some heartfelt quality, something that you don't want to moderate. You really don't. If it goes into its negative manifestation, yes, you would. But in and of itself, it is not only not a problem, but it's something to be cultivated. So what is this? Here it's identified as wishing the best for others. So it's not wanting something for yourself, which often is the form it takes. But it's wishing something for something else, someone else. And, you know, we all know how it feels when someone close to us does something really well or is happy. If you have kids and your kids are happy, that's just a golden kind of feeling. And that's the quality to cultivate. It reminds me a little bit of, in positive psychology, I like to do like gratitude lists. You know, you think of the people who have been most important to you in your life, and you thank them. And it's an amazingly powerful positive feeling. And it's somewhat akin here to love. It's like not only seeing the best in others, but wanting the best in others to flourish. And of course, from a Buddhist point of view, from a Mahayana point of view, it's wanting others to attain supreme like realization. Which doesn't mean, and those of you who are parents know this well, it doesn't mean not to come down hard on them when it's necessary, because that's part of the That's part of love. That's part of wanting the best for someone. So it's something we instinctively do as humans. You know, I think Pema says somewhere that even Hitler liked his dog. Of course, it can be used in the wrong way, but in its first manifestation of that sort of heartfelt regard, that's heartfelt passion. Actually, there's really no word to replace the word love in our language. But it's something not to be moderated. That's why it's immeasurable. We don't try to this is not like the Women Who Love Too Much book. This is a sentient beings who love too little book. It's called Buddhism.
Wonder if, for me, when I think about my love for my daughter, it's but there's also some attachment there. It almost seems like there's love and attachment can coexist.
All of our lives have a certain mandala. You have a daughter. That person's very close to you. You're going to instinctively care for her in a very unvarnished kind of way. The contemplation on love is to extend that further. That your daughter happens to be one particular human being, but you meet particular human beings all the time. None of them else are your daughter. But love is, they could be. You know, the person who serves you next time you go to Dunkin' Donuts or Panera's or McDonald's or wherever you go to, that could be your daughter. Or the person who sends you a bill. Worse, with a penalty because the last bill you didn't quite get to. That could be your daughter, too. So you're extending that heartfelt, pure quality of love to others, mixed with attachment, of course. That's the so-called negative fixation. I think all of us here could write a novel about their history of attachment in this lifetime. I don't think I have to say a whole lot more about that. So, and what is attachment? Miriam was joking to me yesterday. She said, I go to these Buddhist talks and everything is all about, you know, everything winds up to be about one word, detachment. Mm-hmm. Not quite. But close.
Non-attachment would be a better term.
Yeah. Yeah, detachment sounds a little too much like being laid back or indifferent. You know, we're not Klingons. Spock. What was Spock?
Vulcans.
We're not Vulcans. Thank goodness. So what is attachment in terms of love? How does love turn into attachment?
It's getting greedy. It's like wanting something.
Wanting. Yes.
More.
Or sometimes something. Talk to me. Say hello to me, please.
When it's an imagining that the other person controls your ability to be happy.
Yes.
Or the other thing.
Right.
Whether it's a thing or a person. That is the thing that will make me happy.
When will they return my email? I'll be so happy. Yes.
But then there's the positive attachment that, you know, we all need. You know, what babies need and we need as human beings.
That's our life's mandala. Sure, it's our everyday life. Of course. We, you know, if you've been a mother, I mean, what is motherhood but about attachment and the painful separation that begins at birth?
And we have this group here, you know, mm-hmm. all attached to each other.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's but are we attached? All right, that's a good question.
Connected?
Yeah, connected.
Connection isn't necessarily, when we're talking about attachment, I think very much something sticky.
Yeah.
You know, like gummy, like, or walking, getting Velcro all over you, you know, something sticky. Mm. You know.
Well, I'm thinking of it as in the psychological, you know, the way babies become attached.
Sure. Yeah.